looking at a bit of developing a plan for managing, not just managing the classroom, but managing kids and managing issues in the classroom. How do you get together an idea of what you're doing and why you're doing it? And to be honest with you, a lot of teachers don't even have this after many years of teaching. They've just always fly by the seat of their pants. And when you ask them, why do you do that? They've got really no idea, and there's lots of inconsistencies in the way they do it and the way schools handle discipline problems. So hopefully, if you can get this bit nailed at this stage of your careers, then it'll just makes it much easier for you all the way through. So we're going to look at really three areas. The first one is I'm going to pinch about 20 minutes out of a model that I present to teachers. And it's this CPI, which stands for Crisis Prevention Institute. And a lot of schools, a lot of teachers, especially those working in difficult areas such as behaviour schools or in special units, do this training, and it's about how to handle crisis situations, how to protect yourself, how to protect the other students. It's not just limited to violent kids, it's limited to anything. How do you avoid those severe incidents in schools? So we're going to pinch a little bit of that model just to give you an idea of where they're coming from in terms of crisis prevention. We're going to look at a range of the theories. And just briefly, to give you a bit of an overview, because in this area, I don't even know if it's right to call them theories. They're really just approaches that people have developed. And they've usually developed them from looking at what teachers do and then just articulating it. So it's just developing a vocab for talking about things. And if you look at the various models or the various approaches, there's a lot of carryover between the two of them. They draw on each other a lot. But it just gives a good overview and gives you something to talk about or a way of talking about it. And then, and I hope I don't insult you here, but it's mainly for me, I think, this is, we're going to just look at my 9 teaching tips for dummies. You know, draw it to the basic level. Forget all the theories and stuff and just go to common sense approaches that work for me. And I think are really, really important to nail when you're in your in front of the kids in the playground. And you can test that out because you've already had that bit of experience, so it's good talking to you guys because you've already been out there, you know whether it's bullshit or if it's real, right? So you can test it against what your experience is. So do that all the time with everything I say. And please, if you've got something to say or an example from your practice, just throw it up. It's always good to throw that in. So my favourite word. I looked up ugly words in the English language, and I think pedagogy is one of them. It's a terrible word. It sounds terrible. You hear it all the time. Anyone hears it, they cringe. Teachers cringe, you know, when someone brings up good pedagogy. You hear it all the time, so let's talk pedagogy. The meaning of the word is quite interesting. You know, it came from, I think it came from the Greek, and it means the person that took someone to school. You know, the guide or the mentor that made sure the kid got to school safely. Didn't have anything to do with what they did when they got to school. So it's an interesting way we derive it. It's about getting them there, guiding them there. So that's why I think it's the meaning refers to this whole anything to do with teaching. So Queensland call it the art of teaching. New South Wales call it quality skills of teaching because they love that word, quality skills. Tasmania, you know, virtually covers anything. So that's pretty general. So it's really just about the art or the science of teaching. I find it interesting that they throw in that that teaching's neither an art or a science. It's a bit of both, and that's really, really quite real. So that's what we're looking at. How to teach, I guess. And we're teaching all the time. We're teaching not necessarily in the classroom, but any time we interact with people, there's an element of teaching. So it really covers everything, which makes it a very undefined word that we throw around so much. So the trouble I find with it is that it's a bit of a mix of different things. It's all these things we do. You know, you've got information on how to do it. You've got the whole philosophy around why we do it. We've got the skills that you cover, though we don't cover too much of them in our preparation at university. And then there's the personality. What you bring into teaching is really important as well. Now, the trouble I find is that when you're in training, we tend to get a lot of information, a fair bit of philosophy, not much skills and not much attention to your personality and how that's going to work with it, which you've got to have something to draw on. But the trouble is when you get to schools, it works the other way. No one's interested in what your philosophy is or what you know. It's how well you perform at that point when you're in front of those kids. And so it's all about skills and using your personality. Because if you haven't got it, it's a bit late when you're in front of the classroom to say, oh, I've just realised that I'm not very good with people. And I got 30 kids trying to kill me. And I should have been an accountant after all. So really what we need is to make sure we get this match of all those things. So that's what we're trying to do today, is just get this... A bit of a way of matching these up, so we get enough information to know what we're doing. We've got a philosophy, so we know why we're doing it. We've got the skills that match our philosophy, because that's really important. And then all those things work in with our personality. We're not trying to be that teacher that we enjoyed having at school, but is not us. So matching what's going to work for you with what is known to work for everybody. So that is the key. And there's lots of styles. You know, there's lots of teachers that are effective. You know, and there's lots of different approaches to use. And that's the whole point of today, is to do this quick sweep of all these things. So you've got some sort of point to base it on. And we can't go through them all. We haven't got time. But you can go find them. And if you go onto the website, I've tried to put some links to just about any approach you can think of. There's quite a few compilations of the different approaches, the different philosophies, the different learning theories that are tied in with this. So you can research them. I'm just going to pick some key ones. And over the next few weeks, what we'll do is we'll just look at the ones that I really find work for me. But again, they work for me, but there's a range of them anyway. So some you may find some resound a lot better than others. It's just I'm just hoping I've got given you a range enough to find that for yourselves. Okay, so the plan, if you're building a plan for yourself, this is what you start with. You start with, you know, your underlying principles or philosophy. This is your personal one. Everyone's going to be different. You just think the things that make sense to you. And this is what you come back to all the time. Does it fit my framework? Does it fit? You've got a number of models that are going to inform you. And these are the things you can go back to and find a little bit more information about. If you get stuck with things, you can read up on them and say, how do they fit my framework? How are they going to help me be a little bit, put things into practice a little bit more? And then, of course, there is that practice. And that's a constant, I guess this is a constant thing that we're reflecting on. And we're really reflecting on it because we want to be consistent with what we do, with where we're coming from. So I think the key to me, what I notice about good teachers is they have a personal philosophy. They know what they're talking about and it fits that personal philosophy. And when I look at them in practice, it's consistent with their philosophy. If they say they're putting the kids first, then when I see them in the classroom or when I see an incident come up, I can see them putting the kids first. They're not about themselves. They're not about those, they're not full of pride or stubbornness that they can't back down. They will, because they're being consistent with where they're coming from. Whereas some will be that have that inconsistency. It's all very good while things go well. As soon as things go wrong, then they jump to somewhere else. And that consistency or inconsistency is really hard with kids. Okay, so, and all those things feed together, of course. So this is my mission statement, if you like. And those grey guys really come out well on the big slide. This consistent approach with the principles, having those principles that I can communicate. But I don't want consistent actions. I don't want to do the same thing every time. If I've got a kid, every kid's different. I've got to respond differently. So it's not about being, for me, it's not about being consistent in what I do. It's being consistent in why I do it and coming back to, okay, why did you handle that situation different to the one you did last week? Well, because I'm trying to get to the bottom of the problem. I'm focusing on the kid and what's going on for them. This is where the consistency is, even though it might be a different response. And the other thing is, I've got to believe that things will change. That if I hang in there long enough, things will change. And that while not necessarily that I can make any change in a kid, situations change. And as long as I keep in there, things are going to not necessarily get better. Sometimes they need to get worse before they get better. But that there's going to be some sort of difference. And those are those words. And I must say that consistency is the word I hate the most when teachers say you've got to be consistent, because so many times I hear the word consistency used as an excuse for not doing anything or doing something really badly. That kid, we did this, but this kid's completely different. We can't do the same thing. Oh, we've got to be consistent. Doesn't make any sense to me. But really, if we start doing different things and no one understands the reason why we're doing them or where we're coming from, then that's just people don't know what's going on. So really having that clear communication of why you're doing stuff is important, and that's where the consistency comes. So I want to be flexible and I want to be in there for the long haul. So that's something you've got to work on. So this is, I think you've got a bit of an assignment on this, and it's in the textbook. He actually spends quite a bit of time looking at doing this in quite a good way. So develop your understanding of the different approach, and that's what I hope we get through with this. From that approach, pull out where you're coming from. So that's where your platform will start. Your own beliefs, how it fits in with your personality. If you really have a very positive personality and see the good side of people, then that's where you're going to have to base your discipline on. Not that everyone's bad and nasty and trying to get at you, but that you're exploring the positive side of kids and what you can pull out from them. And that's going to be very much a part of your whole approach. So, and then from that, you are going to work out, what are you going to do in the classroom? What are you going to do tomorrow when you step in the classroom? What do I do this afternoon when I have little JC, my Maori kid, who's been sent from New Zealand because they didn't want him on New Zealand streets, so they've sent him to Rosemeadow to, you know, exported him. And he's a funny little character. What do I do with him? I've got to have something there that happens when he walks in the door, as opposed to just a philosophy or a set of principles. I've got to have some skills. I've got to have some approaches that will work with him. So that's the third step. And then, of course, the last step is just going to be always that constant review of things, testing it. Because you're going to get a kid that doesn't fit everything, and you're either going to go down in a heap or just say, okay, what do I need to... Well, I've got a bit of a challenge here. What do I need to change? And hopefully you'll get those kids all your life so that you don't get stuck in a rut, and that's the whole dynamics of teaching. Okay, so I think, if you can get those four steps nailed by the time... Well, three of them anyway, by the time you leave this course this semester, and when you... Integrate it into your the PECs, that'll be really great, because I think you'll feel a lot more sure about what you're doing. Okay, so this is approach from the Crisis Prevention Institute, and just to give you a little background on these people, what they do is... Has anyone done the CPI or the NCI, which is a non-violent crisis intervention course? Yeah. And was it with the, for teaching, or was it for something else you had to do it for? Right. Yep. Yeah, a lot of it. It's a six-hour course, so you can do it on a staff development day, which is... Or at the moment, I'm doing a lot of schools are doing it after school. They do 2 hours for three sessions. And what it really is, it's not just for teachers. When I did the training, originally, teachers were in the minority. The people that were doing this training were prison guards, detention centre workers, mental health nurses, homeless shelter people, people who were putting ambulance officers was the other big one, because ambulance officers are constantly being put in that situation where they go to help somebody and they're getting attacked, and they need to both protect themselves and restrain somebody without actually hurting them. And this is all those situations where we are at the moment as teachers. You know, we can't just sort of, if a kid gets angry and loses it, we can't just bowl him over the head with a chair and say, well, he got angry and I had to floor him. Because, you know, this is where it gets a bit ridiculous. I've had some kids come through. I'll tell you, year four, you guys are lucky. You're all high school teachers, right? The primary school teachers, they think they got it really easy. They think, oh, those little sweet little kids, you know. Year four kids are killers. I've had a number of year four kids come through the suspension centre. I'm not supposed to have them because the government thinks that year four are okay. I'm only supposed to have year five to year 10, or year nine, actually. But the year four kids are the ones that the teachers will... I've had about three kids that schools have said, if that kid walks in, we walk out. And they come in, and I'm thinking, is this guy going to be some, you know, he's going to be a little year four kid with tats and a baseball bat strapped to his side. And this little freckle-faced kid walks in, and I sort of say, where's your big brother? And he says, no, I'm the kid. And this little guy walks in with a sweet smile, and why they're so dangerous is they're so small that when they lose it and they lash out, they seem to connect with the 40-year-old AP and connect him in the knee. And he ends up having knee reconstruction. So it's just the wrong... You know, the high school kids are a bit... At least you can see it coming, you can avoid it. When it's down there, it's just the they tend to do the knees. No, seriously, I've had three or four APs with hospitalised with knees, and it's not the size or the strength; it's just the vulnerability. But these little kids come in. Now you can imagine, you know, you get in front of a court, and there's the current affair, and there's the court there, and this little kid walks in, and he's now very calm and collected, and he says, he hit me with a table. And then the big AP gets there and says, oh, you should have seen him coming at me. And everyone looks at him and they say, you've got to be joking. That little guy. We're made to look like idiots when it comes down to that. Because they paint the picture of the sweet little guy, and the girls are even better. You know, we had that incident earlier in the year, or was it last year? You know, with the footballer and the 17-year-old girl, you know, she got the... And everyone... She was really good at sort of painting it. I'm just a sweet little girl. I've been used by this... And I thought, look, I know some 13-year-old girls, and they're not sweet and little, you know. They're wild women. But we, as a society, we tend to fall for this all the time, and the media loves it because they just love projecting that. And we're the victims, because we have to wear that, and we look so bad because there's no defence. We're adults. We're supposed to be at top. We're in positions of responsibility, and yet we've allowed this to sort of say that these people are equal to us, and it was a fair fight. So that's why they do the training. To work out ways of handling those situations so that we're protected. So the bottom line is that when it comes down to any incident, number one, we've handled it in the first place, so there's no incident as a result, you know, that eventuates. And if there is an incident, and there is the need for some sort of serious restraint or intervention, then we've done it in a way that we're protected. We've done it in a way that's the best practice of the time. And that's why you do the NCI training, so that you can say, I stuck to the principles, and the principles are approved around the world in a whole range of settings, and you can't argue with that. And we're protected in the courts and in our system. So that's why you see a lot of teachers doing it. Now, how well they do it is a different thing, because there's only a 6-hour course, so you go through it pretty quickly, don't you? But I really like this model, because if you stick to this model, you won't even have a lot of the problems. I'll use their terminology. They call this the crisis development model, and they say that a crisis develops with a number of steps. Now, most people have got a pretty good idea of what the steps are. You might have a pretty good idea on these, but I'm just going to go through them really quickly. Four steps in a crisis. The first one, they call anxiety, and we'll look at this in a minute. The second one is, rather than just being that ill at ease, it gets to that defensive stage, you know, where things are building up. It gets to the acting out person is the person that's completely out of control. That is the worst part of the stage. And then the last one they consider is when things calm down at the end. So when you're looking at a crisis, you're not just looking at building into it, but also what happens afterwards. Because for a lot of those kids, a lot of those situations, they're ongoing, they'll happen again. So it's what you can take out of the crisis to make sure it doesn't happen again. So these are the four stages that they're really looking at. And I just run you through really, really quickly. We're not going to do the 6-hour course. That would be a good thing to do. What they call anxiety, and this is the one that you most certainly don't trust yourselves at yet, is just knowing something's wrong. Now, for teachers, what teachers tend to do is they have a sense of stuff and they let it go. You know, the kids come in from lunch and there's just one kid that's not the way he was when he walked out to go to lunch. But he's not doing anything. He's not being acting out really badly. He's not killing somebody. He's not swearing. He's just, you can see, he's just not right. That's when you need to do something, because that's the first stage. For a lot of kids, you can see when they walk into the suspension centre. They've walked in. If they walk in, sometimes they'll walk in with a smile and say, "G'day Ray, how are you going?" And sometimes they just walk in with a, that look. The look doesn't mean anything. I just know that it's not the look that they normally walk in on. So it's worthwhile spending some time trying to work out what's going on, what's happened, what is it. Because I don't want to be the one that it gets taken out on. I want to get it at that stage. And this is really important because, for a lot of those kids, when they do the finger tapping or the tapping the pencil or the chatting with their neighbour, these are all just little things that are indicating something. They're not indicating that they're trying to be disruptive or they're trying to get at me. They're indicating other things. They might be indicating the tapping of the pencil could be that they don't get the work. They don't get what they've got to do. It's that, I don't know what to do. So it's really easily fixed. All you've got to do, is be a bit supportive. "Oh, mate, do you need a hand with your work? Do you want me to explain what you've got to do? How about I do the first couple with you?" And the tapping will stop. The talking will stop. Now, what we tend to want to do, of course, is sort of say, "Stop the tapping." Now, if you do that, what does the kid say? Or, "I'm not tapping." Or, if they're talking, "I wasn't talking." And then you say, "Yes, I saw you talking." Right? You started this argument. Now, it just started with a bit of anxiety. Now it's into the second stage, which is this defensive stage. And this is where they're starting to lose that level of rationality. It's starting to get into an argument. And that's very easy for teachers to push into if they don't handle the anxiety well. And that's one of the biggest problems, that we miss the anxiety stage, we go straight into the defensive stage and we start this argument and we can't get out of it. And if we don't back out of it quickly or we don't handle it really well, then the argument escalates really quickly. And so this one, what we would do is be a bit more directive. This is when we'd say, "You need to put the pen down or put your eyes on me and I'll explain how we're doing things and hope that works. If it doesn't, you've got to lift it up a bit, do this limit setting." And we'll look at this next week, how to set limits. Because it seems to be the thing that comes across all the time. "Oh, we've got to set limits. We've got to explain to the kids what they've got to do. We've got to give these directions, redirect behaviour." But it's not as easy said as done. So we'll have a look at limit setting next week in a little bit more detail, the practical side of setting limits. But that's what we've got to do at this stage, because we've got stuff escalating. And this is the trouble with this stage is it starts with a little bit of irrationality on their part, and it can quickly get to a fair bit of when things get irrational. And if you're dealing with an irrational person, you can't explain to them or put it to them logically and expect a reaction. It's not going to happen. And again, this is a problem. A lot of our discipline is done. Teacher's discipline, school-wide discipline, is done at a stage when the kid is irrational. When the kid's at the front office kicking the wall in, it's not the time to say, "Stop and settle down. You're going to get into trouble." Because the kid will just basically say, well, I won't say what the kid will say, but, it doesn't matter. And sometimes the kids will say, "I didn't say that." And the whole school will say, "Yes, you did. You really did tell him where he could stick his school." But I didn't. "Well, yes, there's 900 kids that heard it, And, well, I don't remember it. because it was so far down that stage of irrational behavior. So that's what we've got to avoid. And now, if you don't avoid that, this is what you get, this acting out person. And within this model, acting out person is out of control. Now, I don't know too many kids that get to this stage. I often ask them, I often ask kids, kids will say, I was completely out of control. I say, well, would you have passed the $50 test? And of course, they always ask me what the $50 test is. And I say, well, if you are, you know, you're screaming at the principal, you're running around, you're knocking the chairs over in the front office, and you're screaming, no, you're not doing what everyone's telling you to do. If I'd have walked up and said, here's $50, what would you have done? And now, there's been a couple of kids that have said, oh, I would have said, you know, fuck you $50 and ripped it up in front of you. Now, and there are some kids like that, you know, they've so far gone that you give them something. You know, those kids, where they do it all the time at home. They'll be the kid that they have a real argument with mum, they go into their room, they get their Xbox and they smash it into the wall. That's a, I've got it, mum, now. And then, you know, they realise, oh, geez, that's my Xbox. What am I going to do now? You know, they've lost it to the point where they just do stuff that they've got no control. But that's rare. That's rare. Most kids would take the $50 and say, oh, okay, I'm out of here anyway. It's just made it better. So that complete lack of control is not as common as we might think. And that is the time when we really supposed to use the restraints and things, when a kid is so dangerous that we've got no other avenue to use. So there's not really much justification for physically grabbing kids or restraining kids within the school setting unless we can guarantee that they're out of control. And that's a hard one, as I say, because most kids aren't. And you know, most good teachers never get to that stage anyway, because they're able to use the last remnants of rational behaviour or any of rationality and calm the kid down or get them out of this place. Yeah. Yeah, and that's part of this training. That tends to be what it is. What the introductory course is about. You don't do how to restrain the kids. You know, if they you just learn how to protect yourself if something gets thrown at you and if someone grabs you. But in reality, what happens is that the teachers say all the time, "What do we do if two kids are in a headlock?" Or you know, like. And how do we break them up? And that's when you use the same principles as you would use on yourself with the two kids. And that's I was in a primary school at the end of last year, and they gave me a scenario, because I keep saying, give me real scenarios, because, you know, these are all the principles and how to do it. But give me, and they had one, because they had a bully grabbed the kid around in a headlock, and the kid was going purple, and they were in a gym, and they couldn't access the kids because they're on the floor and the kid was being suffocated and the other kid was so getting caught up he couldn't see the kid was nearly about to cark it. And the staff are trying, so we actually had to get two of the staff members on the floor, you know, work out how we could apply the principles to break this grip, because if someone, you know, if someone's got a grip and you're just trying to pull against it, it doesn't work. And a lot of the time, it just they grab harder. But there are a number of principles using, you know, finding the weak spot, using momentum, all sorts of ways of manipulating things so you get the best chance of breaking that grip. And it took us a while to work out how we could have rolled the kids to a way to get access to things to break this grip. Now, they did. The kid didn't. I think they just did it by sheer weight of numbers, but they were scared because they knew this kid was being suffocated. So yeah, that's it. And, you know, part of the principles are actually quite simple. Like for breaking up a fight is a classic one. You know, we tend to go in and want to grab somebody. And when you see, the principle is really don't grab anyone. Just come in and just use your hips and your body and your butt. They're great things because they're soft, they're strong, and there's no vulnerability there. They protect you. And it's very effective when you try it and when you do it. It's just going in, protecting yourself, and, you know, a bit of a... And once you get things apart... See, once you get things, you know, the break, often the kids, you've only got to get that little glimmer of rational thought again. I'm away there. He's not hitting me, so therefore I don't have to hit him back. I've got my opportunity, and something will come out of that. It's just getting that first separation that's the key. And this one is, what do you do at the end? And this happens all the time. And even what I was just saying, you know, in a fight, when there's that moment of break, there's an opportunity there to cash in on that. So this is it's important to use this. And I always see a time when a kid loses it as a real chance to work through, because kids don't like it when they lose it. They don't like what happens, and I often hear kids, you know, really. Well, I had a kid the other day. He was an Aspie kid with a learning difficulty. He was fairly low functioning in a whole heap of ways. Had some. But having said that, on other areas, he had a really strange capability intellectually. You know, he had some good skills. His maths was pretty good, even though most of his other areas were pretty poor. So there was stuff that you could work with. But anyway, he was just, as soon as I asked him what had happened at school, he just went into tears because he was ashamed of that he belted his teacher, he belted the principal. He was a big guy. And he'd done all these things that he was deeply ashamed of when he found out what he'd done. But he couldn't, of course, he couldn't go back. So kids don't like what happened. So this, when things calm down, this is what we need to do. We need to have this way of working with them. And I'll show you some things you can use that are very effective. And when you're doing this stuff, it's got to be stuff you can do in 5 and 10 minutes. That's all the time you've got as a teacher to put things into practice. You're not counsellors. You're not there to say, oh, let's sit down for 3 hours and talk about your problems. It's like on the run. It's outside the classroom. It's before the next period starts. It's at lunchtime, it's on the sporting field, it's, you know, while they're watching the soccer game or something. It's just those little opportunities that arise, how to get in and get something productive and not just have a little pep talk. And so we'll look at those. I don't know if we'll get a chance to look at those before you go to PECS, or most probably it might be when you get back. Okay, so that's the basic model. And they call it this integrated experience because what they're saying is what we were talking about before. If I get to that, if I get to that anxiety stage, and I react by being directive, which is the classic example of the pen pushing or the talking, and say stop the talking. Then what do? They start being defensive. So what have I actually done? I've bumped them up a level. So now I've got to the second stage of the crisis, and it was because of what I did. And then if a person is defensive and I start coming in and saying, okay, you're out of control, I'm going to start restraining you, what does a kid do? The kid was just having an argument. Now, they see me coming with my arms up. What's he going to do? You know, That doesn't matter, you're a teacher. At that point, you are just coming at them. They're going to defend themselves. So you've actually pushed it up to the next level. So how many times the teachers say, I know I shouldn't have grabbed him, but the kid's got a suspension because he reacted, or she reacted. And it was of the teacher's doing because of what they did. They didn't handle it. They actually escalated it instead of de-escalated it. So that's why I find this model really effective, because it keeps in your mind, okay, I've got to constantly work the other way. So sometimes it can work the other way. You've got a kid who's directive, and you can say, he's giving you a bit of cheek, and he's saying, sir, this sucks, and, you know, you never helped me. And I say, do you want me to go through the first couple for you? Or, and the kid says, oh, yeah, I don't get any of this stuff. So straight away, you've actually just dropped him back a level, or dropped the back a level. So you've de-escalated it simply because you responded in a different way. And it can work both ways. So it's just important to keep those in mind. Now, what the trainee actually does is spends a lot of time at the defensive level, because it's only one word there, but it's really all those skills, all those verbal skills, all those physical, you know, body language type skills that you use to keep a person from being, from escalating. So you explore that a lot more. And some of the skills that we look at in that defensive stage, we're going to go through in the next couple of weeks. Okay? So I'll just do this. I think this is my slide from the training. So this is what they get tested on, why it's in green. But the reason this works, it really is about avoiding crisis and knowing what you're looking at, and hopefully helping you recognise what's happening. So likewise, if a kid is acting out and you can recognise that at that stage, you don't go in and say, oh, there, just give us a hug, because you're going to get flattened. So it's important both ways. And we looked at this last week, and I was just going to... this is the context these words come in. You know, this is where the kid's got no control, and what we're really trying to do is make sure that dip is as small as possible. The kids aren't going to be perfect, but we can certainly feel a lot more in control ourselves, or that we can use what control the kids have. And I guess the key thing with this, with having that framework and in also having our plan, is that it's really, really important that, you know, we know what we're doing, how to respond. So when we see a kid at a certain stage, we know what we're doing. We've got some steps in place. Now, there's nothing more. This is the best example that I've got. I use this with the kids. I use it with the teachers as well. You remember this? From 2009, where the plane, I don't know if you've seen or heard the cockpit recordings of the pilot handling this crisis. Now, this is a little bit more of a crisis than little Johnny telling me he doesn't want to do the maths work. But it's got a lot of... lessons here, I reckon, for us. So see what you think. This is, it's a model, but it's the real cockpit recordings. Well, no, it's not. Get it.
Okay, you need to return to
Wolverine. Okay, we'll just see if we can get this back again. Love the geese. So it's an amazing, I mean, the guy doesn't give away anything, does he? I mean, you can imagine, well, you know what it's like at that early stages of when that plane's going up. Suddenly, you know, the engines are out. I mean, everyone would be packing it. You know that it's gone quiet. You've got no engines. And he's in one of the largest cities in the world trying to land a plane that's got no control. So, but the thing was, they knew this, that New York City, if you're going out of either of those airports, there's nowhere to land. There's no flat spots for a plane going out. That the Hudson River, he actually brought the plane down close to the ferries. This is how, because he knew that no one actually had, they had a theoretical knowledge of how long a plane would stay on the water, but they didn't know practically if you land the plane, how long before it fills up and sinks. So they practiced in the simulator dropping the plane onto the river as close to the ferries as possible so that the ferries could get over there and get people off. So they got everyone off. And if you remember the story, I think one of the flight crew ended up with a broken arm or a broken leg or something because I don't think she got back to a seat before the plane hit the water. But apart from that, they got wet feet. It was amazing. And, you know, basically all he said was, I just stuck to the plan. I was panicking. I didn't know what to do. Well, I didn't want to be in this situation, but I knew what I had to do because I had my plan. And I just stuck to it. And even though I was panicking the whole time, that's what I just went back to. What's the next step in the plan? What do I need to focus on? And so having that rehearsal, having that practice was what sort of kept things on track. So it's the same for us. If we're not ready, we can't do it when we need to do it. So so hopefully we won't be in a situation that critical, but the lessons are there for us as well. So, just when you look at this, I always find, you know, the theories, there's all these theories and they use these lovely words, whether it's cognitive or behaviourist or behaviour cognitive or constructivist, and And so I just thought I'd try to put these in a little bit of a grouping, three different types of approaches: the behaviourist approaches, the cognitive approaches, and the constructivist approach. So this one is, it's looking a bit more. Behaviourism is saying that you can change, to change the behaviour, we can change the external things. We can change what the teacher does. So the teacher's a bit more focused on the teacher, changing the environment, changing the rules, changing the classroom management system, and, you know, using rewards and punishments, that sort of thing. Now, that it's all of those things can be very effective, and depending on the setting, behaviourist systems are used a lot more. In certain environments, like special settings, where kids need a really highly structured environment, you'll find a big weighting towards behaviourist sort of approaches. And, as I say, I think all teachers use that to a certain degree. But also, there's a lot of work on the cognitive side, which is much more, it's still teacher-centred, but it's focusing on what the kids are capable of doing. It's saying kids actually know what the right way to behave, how to handle themselves. They've got the right sort of thinking, but they don't use it. So what we've got to do is actually help them develop better practices. They're capable, they just don't know how to do it. So we're constantly looking for ways to explore what they're doing and how they can do it better. So it's using their strengths to some element. So that's the cognitive side. So this is something you'd mostly use more in your traditional high school and lots of other approach situations, like, you know, where it's less formal, not outside the classroom. And then the constructivist approach is where it's much more student-centred. And what that's really saying is that learning is this active process. We're drawing on what kids what they know and from their experience, and we're expanding that as they try to develop a perspective of new experiences. How we match those two. So teachers are really a guide, and this works really well in high functioning classes and with kids who are wanting to really expand their potential. And you can use both the other two approaches within this one as well. And this is the classroom I think we'd all like, you know, where the kids come in and say, "What are we doing today, miss? I'm just so excited to be learning something new. You know, show me how to do this. Oh, it's a new game. I've never played American football. I just can't wait to get into it." That sort of environment, and you're just going with the flow and helping them explore their potential. So it's really important to know how to do that as well. So these are some of the skills that we need to get through. And we're going to cover all of these. Have we got any more? No? So rational detachment we did a bit last week. We might get to reflective listening today. And if not, we'll do it the beginning of next week. And that is the key for me. That is the hardest thing to do, and all these things really require you to do that. Your listening skills, because without listening, you're not finding out what's going on for the kids. And if you can find out what's happening for those kids in the first 1 or 2 minutes, then you are set. You pretty well can solve most things. Or you can at least feel like you've got somewhere to start. And then cognitive restructuring is just a way of talking to kids to get some positive response, helping them focus on the issues. Some classroom management approaches. Strength-based interventions, just another way, works really well with those kids that don't respond to other ways of working. So we'll have a look at those. We'll have a little bit more of the non-violent crisis intervention, and we're going to look at technology as well. How can you use that? Because that is a great tool for engaging kids, and engaged kids tend not to have a lot of the problems you've got to deal with. And given the nature of kids these days, that they are thinking differently, they are doing things differently. This is an area that we're actually really poor at exploring in schools because, you know, I think we're making problems for ourselves when we've got all the tools that could minimise them. So we'll have a look at that as well. So they're all the skills we're going to go through to build that plan. I have 10 minutes to the tutorials. Okay. So all these things, I guess, really come down to just effective teaching. So, I get the thing looking at it, it'd be lovely to have a one plan fits all type approach, but unfortunately, kids are different, which is what makes makes teaching really, really very exciting. And if you look at, just looking really quickly at students, the students' qualities, you pretty much get these four groups of kids. While I don't get any of this first one, I really haven't seen the can-do, will-do kid for a long time. Oh, my own kids are like that. They're high achievers. So I get to see them at home. And they're the types of kids that teachers have just got to get out of the way of. You know, don't muck them up because they're on track. They're going to do really well. And all we've got to do is not stuff it up. And then we get these ones who are the can-do but the won't-dos. You know, the bored kids dropped out of the system. They're not so much just the withdrawn ones we were talking about last week, but they're just not motivated. But there's nothing stopping them if they were motivated. So it's about trying to get them fired up. Now, these are the fun kids, the will-dos, but they can't do. So they really need you. So, and they know that, and they're lots of they give you lots of joy because they're motivated and they just can't get enough of you. So they make you feel really good. And these are the kids that that I tend to enjoy because you know, they're obviously not having a lot of success in the system, so anything you do has got to be an improvement. So they struggle both with what they can do and their willingness to do it. So you're really starting with a blank page in a way. And depending where, if you're in a selective school, you're going to be up with that group. And that's got its own problems. Those kids, they're tough because they're going to keep you on your toes. They're going to be wondering, why do you give me 19 out of 20? What did I do wrong? Tell me exactly. Where do I need to improve to get better? And so you've really got to know your stuff. And now with these, you're in the behaviour school. So they can be a pretty difficult and challenging environment. And then you've got some, you know, the special units, the SSPs, where the kids are there, but they've got the deficit skills, deficit behaviours. So you're really just helping them to pick up those skills. So they want to be there. And the trouble is, I guess, that in a mainstream school, you've got all of them. And you've got all of them in great abundance. And trying to handle all of them is a real challenge. And it's easy. You know, if you were sitting in that class, who are you going to be looking at? You know, it's easy just to keep your attention on that kid up the front who's really motivated and ignore the others. And that's where that model that we looked at from the CPI, the NCI, that sometimes we've really got to make sure we focus on those other kids and catch them early because it's so easy to ignore them and then have it escalate. So this is a classic example, and that's what I was going to ask you, Tonya, where they were using this video, and I didn't want to. Well, we'll see, because this has got to be a classic. This pretty well sums up what most teachers experience every day. Now that, it's pretty short, but I reckon there wouldn't be a school that you didn't have, or a class that some of those components in there. And you could look at that, and I'm not going to go into it. You know, if you look at that in your tutorial groups, the reaction of the teacher, if you go back to that model, you know, she was sucked in, wasn't she? He was setting things up. He said things. He wanted to bring her into the argument. She jumped in at the directive stage, and he just loved it because that's where he wanted to go. He wanted to be defensive. He wanted to throw up the, you know, being non-compliant and see where she went with it. And she tried setting a few little limits, and he just, you know, played on those and kept escalating it. So it really does take a little bit of a challenge with a kid like Jonah. And he's not a character of a figment of Chris Lilly's imagination. He's just a representation of what he's seen. Yeah. Oh, made the school. It was the welfare teacher sort of thought he was doing his job. But, look, my honest reaction is, if that's the best plan you can come up with, you haven't got too many tricks up your sleeve. I hope they give you a few more tricks than that to use. Because that contract might be part of something you would work on. But, I mean, a promise from Jonah in a session with the welfare teacher is not going to really count for very much, is it? And so you want to try to get something else from him. Now, and you might remember that Chris Lilly didn't just pick up the negative side of this. If you remember, what was the name of the classroom? The Gumnut classroom. Remember their relationship with the teacher there? It was a different relationship that he had, and he responded differently to that relationship, and how she handled him, and he responded. So if you look at that, you can see some element of a contrast. of how it can be. That doesn't mean he was perfect, because he wasn't. He was still, when he got frustrated, he still did stupid things, and he ended up getting kicked out of class there, I think, at one stage as well. But it was more effective. Yeah, well, she was already fired up looking for a fight all the time. He loves that. Yeah, she wasn't cool, so he played on it. He just loved to get her going. So that level of rational detachment, she didn't have it when he walked in. He knew that she was already rationally attached. Or irrationally attached. So it was like perfect audience for him. So that was the start. Now the other classroom teacher, the thing that she had on her side was she understood Jonah's frustrations. She understood what he needed. So respectfully, she brought up his weaknesses, but he didn't bring them up as a way of focusing on them or highlighting them, just as a way of saying, I know what's going on for you. This is what we can do to fix it. And he, therefore, had some enticement to buy in, at least initially. You know, for how long and for how it was always going to go up and down. But at least had some level of respect there that she could use. So they're good examples, because they are quite real, and you see it all the time with those kids. Like Jonah. So this is our fly through, and we're only going to spend maybe 5 or 10 minutes at the most on this, as I say, and it's just to put some of these names to you. Don't expect to understand too much about them. You can go back and look at these. Fred Jones has an approach called positive discipline. It's an old approach. Most of these guys have been around for a long time, and really it's just saying, using your body language, using incentives. He talks about preferred activity time, which is, you know, give kids rewards, but like they get a reward. If they get all their work done, they'll have a quiz. So the quiz is actually part of their learning. They think they're getting something good. They like doing it, but it's still part of their learning. But it's this idea of providing these incentives and developing positive relationships with kids. Very, very much common sense, very down to earth, and used a lot in a lot of schools in the US, and it underlies a lot of what we do in our approaches. Now, this one's a famous one, Koonin, preventative discipline, and he looked at a lot of schools, and he just looked at what teachers did that was effective, what effective teachers did. And he noticed that effective teachers had the same number of disruptions as ineffective teachers, except they stopped. So it wasn't they walked into a class and none of the kids talked or none of the kids did anything that was against the run of the classroom. But what happened is they were addressed and minimised. So he just really put labels on these things. Things like the ripple effect. You know, that idea of singling out some kid, either in the positive or the negative. So if you say, Daniel, will you stop talking, please? Then the three kids around Daniel also stop talking. But likewise, if you say, hey, I really like the way you're looking at me, you're ready to get the instructions, you're going to be able to get this done and you won't have any homework. And suddenly half the rest of the class is looking at you because of that ripple effect. Those are, you know, it's a common thing, sense, the fact you've got to be with it. You've got to be aware of what's going on all the time. You can't be over this side of the classroom and not aware of that. You know, you've got to have sequencing, you've got to have flow, you've got to be doing things all the time. The kids have got to have that idea that at any one stage they might be called upon to give an answer, so that they're focused. All those things he goes through. And again, they're just common sense things that, not that he pulled out of the air or their theory, just identified that this is what effective teachers tended to do. Canter and canter was assertive discipline, and this was, again, it was just about having clear rules, positive consequences, and we're going to have a look at this in more depth, so I won't even go into that at all. That's one of the approaches we'll spend some more time on. Now, Skinner looked at conditioning. applied behaviour analysis. He was getting rats to run through mazes and, well, not mazes, but electrified cages, and pigeons to talk. Well, not talk, but recognise they could read. And so a lot of stuff in terms of conditioning and positive reinforcement and reinforcement schedules and things like that. And we tend to use a lot of his ideas in special ed when talking about structured environments and functional assessments, things like that, identifying what changes we can make in the environment to get changes in behaviour, and identifying the triggers for kids. What triggers certain behaviour? What conditions tend to lead to a higher level or a higher incidence of behaviour? And then how do we change those? How do we modify those conditions so that we can change the behaviour? So it's a classic behaviour modification type ideas. And Bill Rogers pulled a lot of those ideas together. And he's an Australian guy that, as young teachers, you often get a chance to see Bill Rogers. And he talks about, rights, rules, responsibilities, and having this behaviour management. And some of the things he draws upon is not focusing on secondary behaviours. You know how you see a kid is talking, and then the teacher says, you're always picking on me, sir. And then they say, oh, I'm not picking on you. And straight away, the teacher's focusing on the secondary behaviour, not the first. Whereas Bill Rogers is spending a lot of time on the economy of language, what you say, how you focus on the original one, and just keep coming back to that broken record. No, you just need to stop talking. We need to get through the work. And keeping it very civil, using a bit of humour, and just low-key but effective and very practical sort of approach. Glasser is an approach that seems to be coming back. Glasser's an old guy. He's still around. But interesting, his stuff's been around there for a long time, and it's starting to go into vogue because it's looking at assessments and the way schools are structured. And he looks at both behaviour and he looks at the wider scheme of things. So about mastery learning, looking for competence as opposed to just passing, and this whole idea of creative thinking, of creating students who can think for themselves and who can taking out certainty. It's an interesting time to be teaching, because even when we talk about science, I ask the kids, I do a lesson with the kids on Australian history, I ask who discovered Australia. The kids all say Captain Cook. Now, when we think about it, we think that's a ridiculous statement. We know that Australia was around, even in European history, for years before Captain Cook ever got there. And we know that there was even Dutch sailors marooned on West Australia in the 1600s. So we don't even know what happened to them. And so by 1770, Captain Cook bumped into the East Coast, but Australia was nearly completely mapped there. But so what kids learn is always changing. There's no certainty in it. So we can't teach from a point of view of certainty. We've got to minimise that. I always love teaching science at the moment because, we're reading all the time that things are broken down into atoms, and now they're starting to say, oh, yes, but it's not about matter. It's about the universe is made up of antimatter. I don't even know what antimatter is. But I learned that it was all made up of atoms and molecules and matter. Now they're saying this dark matter is everywhere, and that's the bulk of the universe. Well, so what does that mean about what I was taught? It's all out the window. So to be able to say that this is what's true is not effective. So this is what Glasser is about. And cognitive behaviour, this is really just looking at focusing on changing your thinking. Where are kids coming from? What's behind their thoughts? And then there's that whole idea, we were talking about this before, of understanding behaviour in terms of the goals. And then the humanist approaches are saying, how do we build relationships with kids? And when you look at these guys, Gannat is a classic, and we'll have a quick look at some of his ideas. And that's really about those teachers that get on with kids and don't have problems with them. And it's about negotiating and about encouraging, but not praising. Praising is seen as pretty much a negative thing, because it's a general thing. It's not a specific. It's a bit condescending, but it's about encouraging, picking up what kids are actually good at, and being able to give them direct feedback about what's effective for them. So all those things. And the last one is the strength-based, which is the solution-focused. And this is a really good one for those kids that don't respond to anything else. And so we will have a look at this one in a bit more depth as well. And it asks the question, you know, like most kids aren't a problem all the time. When are they not a problem? What's different? How can that? I had a kid, the classic example was a kid that came to me a couple of years ago. He was in big trouble at school. He was all the time arguing with teachers. He was a big kid, so the teachers were threatened by him. He was a year 9 kid. And I was talking to him a little bit, about 5 minutes. And it came up that he was refereed junior rugby league games. And he refereed a lot of them. And he'd been refereeing them for quite a few years. And I said, oh, gee, how do you handle it when the parents start, you know, challenging your decisions? He says, oh, I got the whistle. I said, so it's not an issue. And so this kid, who couldn't handle anything at school, was handling refereeing junior rugby league 3 times a weekend, and not being fazed by any of the stuff that was being thrown at him, the abuse, the questioning his authority and everything. I said, well, how do you handle it? He says, oh, you know, he went through all the things that he does. You know, he didn't not hear it. He heard it, and it got him going because he knew it was unfair. But he just said, no, my job's to referee the game. He let it. I said, how come he can't do that at school? And the thing was, he knew how to handle himself. Because he did it on the footy field as a referee. He was using all the skills he needed to do in the classroom. He just hadn't put the two of them together. So he didn't need to be taught the skills. Didn't need someone to sit down and say, I've got to show you how to behave, because he knew how to do it. He just needed to use it. Use what he could do. I don't know if I could have given him a whistle. It might have upset the teachers if he just kept blowing it when he got annoyed. But I think he reckons he had it all sorted by the time he left. It was like the penny dropped. He thought, well, okay, yeah, maybe that's all I got to do. So they're the four approaches we're going to focus on. We're just going to go through those because I find they're the most useful and the quickest to get on top of, and that cover a pretty wide spectrum. So over the next few weeks, we'll cover a couple of those in each of the weeks. So, just to give these a bit of perspective really quickly, is think of them on a continuum. This is where you're more autocratic and, you know, more democratic, and these are really up there. We don't use too many of these, where it's... Though, in certain situations, when we did the wilderness program, we were using a lot of non-directive sort of approaches, because sometimes if you're in a situation where you say to the kid, don't jump off the cliff, it's like putting a flag there saying, jump off the cliff, you know, I'll see how far I can jump. So you've got to use ways that get round that confrontation with the kids. So, you drift around here. So I think you guys, especially in the situation, when you're outside, when you're in situations where you can't control, four walls are a great starting point. I always thought teaching PE, PE teachers have to you know, everyone thinks it's the wonderful, wonderful sort of situation, but not having those four walls is a real pain. I think for some classes, I used to think it was like teaching, working with a box full of sparrows. You know, you get them outside and you open the box and then the sparrows, and you've got to try to catch them from everywhere. So you really need some skills at attracting them rather than containing them. And so each of these models, you can see, and where they fit in is that often we start with approaches like this. The first time you see a class, you might be much more teacher-centered, a lot more conveying what you want. And as time goes on, the class becomes much more democratic. So you don't stick with any of these. Sometimes you bounce around. Your top class in your selective school or even in any school, you're most certainly not going to need this. You're going to be more democratic, more laissez-faire, trying to stimulate them and then you would with one of the other classes. So you're moving around between these all the time. And that's why it's good to know where the models fit in. So you can have a bit of an idea. So, and these are the approaches I just said to you. And they're all on that continuum, but I don't think we'll worry about that. But this is just one thing I did want to say before we look at the dummies teaching skills, was really what we've got to do the whole time is... And when your teachers are telling you, when your supervising teachers are working with this, put this test to what they're saying, to whether to take it on board or not. Now, always agree with them, first of all. That avoids any problems. But that doesn't mean you necessarily believe what they're saying. So the way to test it is this auditing system. So it's really matching where they're coming from with what they're doing. And I'll give you a classic example of where we have this inconsistency. You know, we all the discipline systems, all the welfare systems in the school will say students need to be responsible for their own behaviour. We need kids to take on board that responsibility. Yet when we, when we suspend them and we have them return to school, most of the time the issue by which they were suspended has never been dealt with. The classic example is the kid that has the argument with the teacher. The teacher says the kid's stupid and the kid says, well, you know, fuck you, sir, you can stick your school up your bottom. Right? Now, that's where it was left. And it's usually a lot worse than that. You know, I'm being nice to you so we can keep it polite. That's where it's left. 10 days goes by, the kid comes back, and they're both sitting there as if nothing happened. And we're saying, oh, yes, but you know, you've got to resolve your conflicts. You've got to deal with things. You've got to communicate. You've got to talk through your issue. None of that's happened. So all the things we say we believe in, none of it's actually happened. So there's a great... This just doesn't match up. So either we've got to say, look, we don't really want kids to be responsible for their behaviour. We just want them to do what they're told. We'd be a lot more honest if that's what we said. Schools will only function if kids do what they're told. But I don't think society will let us run schools like that anymore. So we're caught out. So therefore, we can't change that. Then maybe we've got to change that. So some schools do. Some schools will make sure the kids have some sort of restorative practice where the kid's got to work out what they're going to do to make up for the incident, or the teacher and the kid will sit down at the before returning to school and resolve the differences and talk through what happened and talk it out. But that's where we've now got a match. So when you hear teachers say this is what they do, and you know that they're saying but you do it for this reason, it doesn't match, then take it with a grain of salt. As I say, nod in agreeance and then make sure you do what you matches your beliefs. So, 9 tips. I can never seem to get 10. Most of my things seem to be in 9s. But then 9 is a magic number. If you've ever got time, I'll show you why everything comes back to nines. Really, really simple. We're just going to go through them really briefly. You know, we've got all the theories. This is just cutting through all that stuff. First of all, your expectations, being realistic. You know, we all would like to make a difference. We all want kids to, you know, get a joy, be healthier, whatever it is. But really, it's not about my expectations. In some ways, it's not about going in without expectations, but not holding those expectations as crucial to my well-being. I don't go in to make a difference with kids. I can't do that. I can't control that. I can't do if a kid walks out and commits suicide tomorrow, I can't be responsible for that. And likewise, I can't be responsible if that kid goes out and becomes a wonderful member of society. I can't say I did a fantastic job with that kid. I can only do my job and as best I can do, and that kid will take... I can't control how they take that on. And so I've got to be realistic in my expectations. Otherwise, I'll knock myself around too much. And then I'm not effective. I'm not effective to those kids, and I'm not effective in the system. So the realistic expectation. And as part of that, I really do need a thick skin. I need to take the knocks. Sometimes people think that, yeah, work at the suspension centre, I do need more than just a metaphorical one, but it's not true. Just got to be able to bounce. Language is a thing with these days. You saw with Jonah. Got to take a little bit of the language sometimes. It slips out. And how we take that is important. So this one I think is really key. Kids like to focus, take things out on us. To move around. I don't mean physically as much as mentally. You know, don't let them get their bearing on you. Jonah knew what his English teacher is like. She's predictable. She's so predictable. From talking about her Suzanne blouse to he knows what the reaction's going to be. So you're not a friend to the kids. And this is where you guys that do the outdoor ed and stuff, because you get to see the kids in different situations, but you also know you can't be their friend, you can't be their parent, you can't be their teacher. Well, you know, you've got to be a bit of everything. You're just somebody that they can see that has a little bit of all those roles in them. You're moving from... And therefore, if you're not their parent, then they can't treat you like their parent. They can't dismiss you like their parent. They can't... You know, if you're not just the teacher, then they can't just minimise your role in their life as they would, say, someone in the school. And like you're not their friend because you've got more to contribute than their friend. You've got more power, more authority, more worth to them. So you're all those things. That's what I mean. You're moving around. You keeping things keep them guessing in a little, in some ways. And I think that helps. And it's more than just, you know, I said to you, your youth was a great advantage, but it's not the only advantage. It's something you can use. So it's not just trying to go out there and saying, I really care for these kids and I want to be a good teacher. You've got to have some skills and you've got to work at it. And you've got to... Sullenberger flying that plane, he was a good pilot, but it wasn't that he was a good pilot that got that plane down, it was that he had practice and he knew what he was doing and he knew how to keep his cool and when things got rough, and he put all those things into practice when the time came, and that was what got it going. And really, oh, gee, going to do it again now. Whoa. And kids like that. They like getting that reaction. So you're the biggest button, really. They just love to get a reaction, especially because the other kids, they get the kudos from the other kids to get you going, to get those comments, to get it. Really, just avoid that at all times. I think this one is mostly the key for me. It's more about poker than pedagogy. It's really knowing how to win your battles, how to handle your emotions, how to it is about theatre. It's about presenting things in ways. It's about taking the most boring topic and putting some excitement into it. It's about throwing, you know, your whole body into things and your whole and I tell you, the best kids to teach, if you ever want to do some really fun teaching, take on the IO kids. If you know what the IO kids, you know, the IM kids are the intellectually moderately disabled. But IO is one less. Often they're the kids with Down syndrome and whatever, and they are just fun. Oh, look, I don't even know. It's one of those things it's a funny sort of label. It's saying they're really low functioning, but of course everything is about theatre. For them, it's just there's so much joy and fun in learning at such a basic level, but they've got to see it, they've got to feel it, they've got to get the whole package. So your teaching is just full on. It's just so exciting. And really, trust your instincts. If you haven't got these instincts, then I suggest then change your occupation. Because if you want to wait, if you try to wait until you've got everything under your belt and you know what's going on, then it's going to be too late. Even for experienced teachers, they trust their sense of things, what's going on, and take a risk. And there's no harm. I don't believe you can do any harm by jumping in and asking kids if something's going on or is this or having a guess at what's happening. All they'll do is say, no, you're wrong, which means you can guess again. And you can dismiss that as not being the issue. So it really is about trusting your instincts. And trusting your ability to use your instincts. And that's where I'd really encourage you. And this one is it's that what we're talking about, that rational detachment, being able to keep you cool and how to get it back if you lose it. It's just so important. And then the last one is chunk, funk, dunk. And that whole idea that, okay, it's all right having the control, everything, but still we've got to give the kids the learning, the content, in a way that they can get it. And it's just as important for you guys outside doing a PE lesson because, you know, so many kids have got very little capability in that area, and some kids are so far ahead. So making it clear, being able to break it down into steps they can believe they can do, being able to make it interesting so that each of those steps is exciting and engaging, and then that last thing, if it doesn't leave them with a sense of accomplishment, then you're not going to get them in the next time. And yet that success, that element of achieving a challenge and getting over a hurdle is really, really satisfying for them. So that's just as important. So all those things, your expectations, taking a risk, avoiding losing your cool and making it interesting are really important. So there's the 9 tips. And I reckon if you do that, you'll enjoy your teaching. And hopefully over the next 2 weeks, what we'll do is we'll look at some of these practical approaches, and we'll try to do two a week over the next two weeks so we get four done. Okay, so we'll see you next week.